I should point out that what you're about to hear is not the same as the paper you have in your conference pack. This one is a little bit longer and vastly better proofread. So I was writing two listener columns at the time I sent this off to Colin. So unfortunately I won't be around to discuss this at the end of the day. Due back in Auckland for an event of great cultural significance at Eden Park. I suppose I should ask, is there anyone who doesn't know what a blog is?
Tell us what a blog is.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you anyway. It's an online journal, frequently updated, displayed in reverse chronological order so that the newest content is at the top. That's actually quite a critical feature, and you're seeing that bleed over to the news media now, that facet of blogs. And typically contains outbound links. That's the joy of blogging. My one, Hard News, was for 11 years a radio commentary whose text was posted to the internet and developed quite a following. But I stopped doing that and I reinvented it as a blog because I didn't just want to tell people about things, I wanted to actually be able to direct them to original resource materials. And that's really the joy of hyperlinking in your blogs. The handful of men who decreed the terms of what we now know as the internet were benevolent dictators. They made decisions on the basis of what was, in engineering terms, no more and no less than good taste. They weren't averse to using more than moral suasion. They controlled a good deal of research funding, and they made it clear that universities that did not heed their instructions on crucial issues could expect to see the money dry up. But, at the same time, they established a process that allowed their decisions to be tested by a community. The Request for Comment, or RFC. In comparison to the procedures of institutional standards bodies, RFCs are remarkably informal. Their distribution is typically unlimited. In principle, anyone in the world can respond to one. Joke RFCs are published every 1st of April. RFC 2486, published in 1998, is not even a technical document, but a remembrance of the first RFC editor, John Postel, the father of the internet. It is informal, and yet it is arguably the most effective development of practice in modern history. The standards and protocols that emerged from it facilitate every move we make on the internet today. Competing network standards from some of the most powerful companies in the world have come and gone, as did one anointed by the United Nations. The internet's benevolent dictators did not simply win their technical argument. To the extent that environment determines culture, they set in place not only the engineering principles of the internet, but its cultural template. By their own example, they established a pattern that occurs time and time again on the internet, a pattern of motivated individuals and mobilised communities. This is the pattern we see now in what we like to call the blogosphere, sometimes to spectacular effect. During last year's US election campaign, CBS's News 60 Minutes program ran a controversial story on President Bush's military service, based on a hitherto unknown memo from his commanding officer. The conservative blog Powerline was anointed Weblog of the Year by Time magazine for its work in showing that the memo was forged. But in fact, Powerline's authors did little more than ask the question. The real legwork was done by a horde of readers, some of whom displayed a zeal and expertise that put professional journalists to shame. More recently, blogs on the other side of the divide used a similar division of labour to demonstrate that a mysterious conservative journalist given press accreditation to the White House was working under an assumed name, that the news organisation he worked for was nothing of the kind, and that his services as a gay prostitute were being advertised explicitly on the internet. In that case, the labour of investigation was actively allotted to willing readers. Volunteer investigators took their job, went out, found the information. This is the modern phenomenon of the blog swarm, something that is as dizzying and angry as its name suggests. It has encouraged some commentators to hold forth, usually in their own interest, on power of the blogs. This power is so great, it is held, that the millions of individuals with their online journals will supplant the mainstream media. But bloggers would soon run out of things to say, were there not a steady flow of professional journalism from which to feed. With this in mind, the professionals, again with their own interests to the fore, like to depict the blog hordes as no more than unprincipled amateurs. In reality, good bloggers are neither the slayers of the mainstream or mere news parasites. They are information entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurialism is the novel combination of resources that results in an increase in wealth. And just as we depend on financial entrepreneurs to increase society's overall wealth to take us forward, so we depend on information entrepreneurs to make the connections that increase our wealth of knowledge. It is not a matter of power. It is a matter of the usefulness of individual voices. And that's a story as old as the internet itself. Linux, the open source operating system that powers much of the internet, was the brainchild of one man, the Swede Linus Torvalds. But it is the work of thousands who cleave to the collaborative sharing process overseen by Torvalds. Any work created by one Linux developer can be used by any other. There are many other examples, including some which speak directly to the issues of this conference. We all know about Google, the G word. Fewer of us really understand why Google rose from almost nowhere to command its industry. When its founders, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, began to shop around their ideas in 1998, search engines worked badly. The big companies behind them had compromised their integrity by selling results. No one seemed interested in fixing the problem. One chief executive memorably told Page and Brin that our users don't really care about search. Which is astonishing. We did, of course, and Google embodied a simple, brilliant idea. It was effectively to ask us what we thought was important. If a website had many inbound links to it, or its key people were name-checked elsewhere, it was considered to be a trusted part of a community, and its ranking reflected that. In doing a Google search, we could draw on the knowledge, experience, and good taste of everyone else. In the same year that Page and Brin began to go out and seek support for their idea, an older internet venture underwent a rite of passage. The Internet Movie Database was acquired by Amazon.com as the technology bubble expanded. IMDb emerged in 1990 as really just an undifferentiated mess of information about movies. Its founder, Colin Eden, was simply a film fan, as were the people who started to send him cast lists and biographies. But, as a Unix computer programmer, he had access to an engineering heritage that helped it steadily develop into a resource without parallel. IMDb now attracts 18 million visits a month, but the multi-million dollar deal with Amazon has done almost nothing to change its essence. Its greatest resource is still its community, the 100,000 individuals who feed it information. 70% of IMDb's staff resources are devoted to ordering this information. Created and nurtured outside the screen industry, IMDb is now that industry's primary information resource. These riches of community extend, of course, far beyond IMDb. There are volunteer websites for stars, movies, franchises, TV shows. There are even websites for individual episodes of cult TV series. And in many cases, the phrase fan site doesn't do them justice. On these sites, there are episode guides, guides, histories, up-to-date biographies, all the things that the owners of the original content did not think or did not bother to provide. There are examples closer to home. After a false start, Peter Jackson realised that it was better to hold close the creators of the OneRam.net rather than serve them with trespass orders. And TVNZ should be grateful to Regan and Rachel Cunliffe, the creators of the Idol blog website, for providing the New Zealand Idol franchise with a persistence and sense of community that it simply would not have had otherwise. A similar principle is at the heart of a far more ambitious feature launched 4 years ago, Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia that anyone can edit. You may be familiar with the standard criticisms of Wikipedia, that it's fed by amateurs with agendas, that it can't be trusted. Well, a sign that Wikipedia's great strength is also its great weakness came recently when it emerged that one of its newer entries on British pop star Jamie Cain was fictional. Cain never existed. He was a character in an online game launched by the BBC. His biography had been added to Wikipedia by a staff member in a misguided attempt at viral marketing. The entry was swiftly corrected without deleting the original and aligned with the Wikipedia process, but it appears it may not have been the only stunt of its kind. So there is still a place in the world for authority. But consider this. Most of you will be familiar with Te Ara, the Encyclopedia of New Zealand Online. Some of you may be surprised to discover that it does not contain a biography of the late David Longy. More surprisingly, neither does its online sibling, the Dictionary of New Zealand Biography, which does not trifle with the living, nor apparently rush to judgment on the departed. They are not alone. 2 weeks after Mr. Longy's passing, the Encyclopedia Britannica, online but not up to date, had still not noticed his loss. So where might a New Zealand school child turn to discover what all the fuss about this Longy chap was about? Well, a Google search on Mr. Longy's name would render as its first result the Wikipedia entry for David Longy. That page correctly identified him as deceased within a couple of hours of the news being made public, and in the days that followed, it blossomed into something really quite special, including another part of what Wikipedia offers, a Wiki Quotes page. I can't actually think of anyone in the world who more deserves a Wiki Quotes page, and I can recommend the David Longy one to you. All compiled by volunteers, by members of the public. It's great. It really is a good read. Now, I understand that when Te Ara was conceived, the idea of user-generated content was specifically rejected. This was a mistake. A great idea could have been even greater. And if there is one part of the Te Ara site that grieves me, it's the section on New Zealand music. The last 15 years have seen an emergence of national identity in our popular music that is as significant as the arrival of a characteristically New Zealand literature in the 1930s. And yet, because there hasn't been time to do it, the New Zealand music entry in Te Ara is little more than a brochure. I would love to be able to help build a deep and broad resource here, and I'm not alone. We have knowledge and skill, but there is no way in for us. As I noted, not everyone sees user participation this way. In a rather spiteful essay earlier this year, Robert McHenry, the editor-in-chief of Britannica, dubbed Wikipedia the faith-based encyclopedia, and compared it to a public restroom where the visitor, quote, does not know who has used the facilities before him. In fact, the reverse might be argued. On any Wikipedia page, you can click a tab to see its editing history, who added what, when, every previous instance of the page, and the discussion about the changes. Effectively, you not only know who has used the restroom, but exactly what they did in it. There's a parallel here with the internet engineering process and its RFCs. No RFC can ever be unpublished, even if it's obsolete. The argument must be forever apparent. Bloggers often embrace this principle without even realising it. If a blog post later proves to be wrong or intemperate, the ethical thing for the author to do is generally not to delete it, but to make another post, or to annotate the original. This relates to an expectation of actuality in the internet age, an expectation to which libraries and archive organisations are and must respond to. People today do not want to simply hear of a thing, or have a thing explained to them. They want to confront the thing themselves. We have seen to quite revolutionary effect a shift of this order in political life in New Zealand. 10 years ago, access to official reports and draft laws was the preserve of a select few, mostly in Wellington. Now, almost all of that is online. Similarly, we no longer have to settle for reading about party and lobby group press statements via the media. They're all posted to scoop.co.nz, the national notice board of political life. But members of the public can not only view these things from anywhere on the internet, they can direct others to them. So a good political blog post might draw together a moment from Hansard, a ministry report, an old story from the Herald, today's party political press release, and of course a comment from another blog, all to make an argument. That's what being an information entrepreneur means. We saw an even more striking change in the relationship between the community and the media with last year's Indian Ocean tsunami and this year's terrorist bombings in London. Personal accounts of the tsunami in blogs and emails formed such an important part of the coverage that the British National Library moved to harvest and preserve them. We're seeing the same thing happen amid the chaos of New Orleans right now. In London, on July the 7th, the major London newspapers appealed for eyewitness accounts as soon as the news broke and published them on receipt. To a remarkable degree, people seemed to know what was required of them. Their accounts were concise and relevant. And I also must mention the London bombings page on Wikipedia, which was remarkable because it not only kept up with breaking news better than the mainstream news media did, it gave the kind of depth of background that no one did. And I think that's a really extraordinary thing, that an encyclopedia in 2005 does breaking news better than anyone else. By the end of that day in London, the BBC had received 30 mobile phone videos of events and more than 300 digital images from the public. Its head of news talked of a gear shift in the broadcaster's relationship with its audience. The BBC, which I think is leading the way now, just as it exemplified the vision of Lord Reith in another age, has acknowledged that relationship in another way, with something called BBC Backstage. This is a part of its website where the BBC says, "Perhaps you know a better way to harness our information than we do." On BBC Backstage, programmers are given full access to the BBC site's feeds to use in new ways. Among the most useful hacks have been blends of the news feed and the equally open geographical mapping service provided by Google. Those without programming skills are invited to simply contribute ideas for things they'd like to see. Similarly, in drawing up a schedule for release of material under its Creative Archive policy, the BBC asked the public what they would like to see first. It turned out to be nature and science programs. And further, the first release under the Creative Archive project is explicitly intended for derivative use, a series of clips for VJs to mix live video images for company music. Can libraries accommodate this kind of shift? I think they have many times. When libraries, as we know, first appeared in classical Greece, only a select few could actually see the books, and they were never allowed to wander amongst the stacks. The Romans established libraries as public facilities, but for many centuries, books were far too expensive to be actually allowed out the door. They were literally chained to the shelves. And, as Robin Hyde noted in The Singers of Loneliness, her lyrical observation of an emerging New Zealand culture, in the 1930s, many New Zealand libraries did not permit the copying of manuscripts by anyone. That would seem indefensible now. At this point, I should declare an interest. The group blog site I run, Public Address, attracts between 5,000 and 6,000 visits a day. I think our authors all make a useful contribution to the national conversation, and that some of what is said there will become part of our cultural history. Last year, I introduced a new feature for public address, an historical blog called Great New Zealand Argument. I'd become aware that there was great writing of argument that had direct relevance to the kind of contemporary issues discussed daily on our site, and I wanted that writing to be seen. Our first post was the transcript of David Lockie's 1985 Oxford Union debate speech. It turned out to be the first published transcript of this iconic speech. It was read 10,000 times in its first week and a half online. It took only 3 days for it to rise to the top of Google rankings for the relevant search strings. No one had to make that so. It happened because that's how Google works. The second work posted was Bill Pearson's Fretful Sleepers, an essay accorded great significance in the study of New Zealand literature, but out of print and unavailable to the public. 5,000 people read that in a week, more than had accessed it via the Turnbull Library in a decade. This year, that historical blog became a book, Great New Zealand Argument, Ideas About Ourselves. Just before I travelled to Wellington, I formed a publishing company as well, we agreed that it should go into a second printing, meaning it's covered its costs. I should note that the book has sold well despite nearly everything in it being already available on the internet. I've been able to offer compensation in cash or kind to those who took the original leap of faith and let me put their work online. Indeed, perhaps the nicest thing about the project was being able to buy old Bob Gormack a good bottle of whiskey for a poem that even he had forgotten he'd written. The book has also afforded me the pleasure of meeting one of its contributors, the former head of the Turnbull, Jim Trowey. It's also been a delight to make the acquaintance of the Turnbull's Philip Raymer, who's been extremely supportive, and I look forward to working with Philip in the future, because I regard Great New Zealand Argument as a franchise. I have three ideas for three more books, I just can't quite decide which one I want to do first. Now, I'm not an expert on New Zealand literature, or any literature. I'm an ignoramus. My tertiary study career consists of one essay on The Merchant of Venice that I wrote without benefit of having actually read the play. I passed. My innovative angles of argument were noted by the examiner. So, I'm not an expert, but I know what I like, and I'm motivated, and there is value in that. And also, I have to say, effectively, as a modern pamphleteer, I'm really excited by the knowledge that the original Turnbull bequest includes more than 6,000 pamphlets. I was recently able to bring this part of the project to a kind of closure when I liberated the Lockie speech itself. And I say liberated advisedly. I was originally able to only gain on-site listening access, the recording from sound archives, in order to transcribe the speech. I negotiated for months to try and get the recording released online with the approval and support of Mr. Lockie. But the day before he died, I got the final word from Radio New Zealand. I could use the recording, but not make it available in any form that could be downloaded. But this wasn't good enough for me. Not only would it have an adverse bearing on quality, it also precluded derivative uses. I quite liked the idea of those ringing words being sampled and worked into a dance record. And so might I say to David Lockie, actually. Eventually, a last-minute plea to TVNZ bore fruit. The recording can be downloaded by anyone, and over 3,000 people have so far. It is linked to, along with a transcript, from Wikipedia, and as of this week, from the website of The Economist. And that dance record is in the works. Finally, I fulfilled the expectation of actuality. I must emphasise that I don't blame any individual for the difficulties of this process. Archive organisations need policies and, on a more practical level, funding for this kind of project. It's my fervent hope that in the next few years, both the policies and the funding will be forthcoming. It's truly exciting to see the National Content Strategy take shape. And if I could have one wish, It's that the strategy will admit New Zealanders. The blessing and the curse of libraries and archives is their sheer breadth. Having decided to disseminate, what to disseminate first? The answer, at least in part, is to disseminate what people want. I imagine a modest, simple fund to digitise works on request from the public. Perhaps someone wants a work to illustrate an argument, to enhance a Wikipedia entry, or simply for the pleasure of making it available. Once it is published, like those old RFCs, it can never be unpublished. My point is this, that the keepers of knowledge can either operate a command economy with 5-year plans, or they can let in the information entrepreneurs. They can be the benevolent dictators who start the rule. I would hope that it will soon be possible for motivated individuals to make their own paths through our great common heritage. For our great archives to be adorned and enhanced with wikis, web projects and blogs. That our online encyclopedias can harness the power of community. And that there will be a flowering so broad and so fast growing that it would be hard to count its blooms. And if it does prove hard to draw this activity together, to get a grip on what's going on, you may anticipate my answer, start a blog.